So I think it's one of the most important things that people are missing right now about this market. You really need to look under the hood beyond the headline data. Regardless of what happens in Iran in the short term, we are already on a path to, let's call it, a contracting economy. I would invite everybody to look at what's happening January through March of 2008. That's when the last time we saw this really huge oil spike into the end of cycle. Very similar kind of characteristics right now.
Ben Kazimchuk is a portfolio manager at Wellington Altus, helping high net worth clients grow and protect their wealth.
Known for his innovative client-first approach, Ben advises families, professionals, and business owners with full-service, personalized strategies.
This is all very indicative. This is all very classic bear market stuff. You don't really see a lot of that outside of bear market activity. The fact that we've seen this rally over the last 7 days is not indicative that we're going to go back to all-time highs. It's actually, in my opinion, really characteristic of the first types of rallies that you see in larger bear markets. And that is the really big warning sign that people are missing. It's the fact that you have your market leaders that are still down and still not responding to this flow activity. That's your real signal.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. And welcome, Ben, back to the show. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Pascal. I'm happy to be here with you. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. And obviously, I'm very much looking forward to talking to you again. It was back in early October, I guess, when we last recorded. And that was quite interesting for me because you were one of the few people who started like cautiously sounding or ringing the alarm about the funding stress, you know, that was going on back then. And I guess a lot of things that have happened since then, like funding stress kind of has calmed down, at least what I have experienced or what I've seen. Equity markets have become a little wobblier, I guess, you know, but if you look here today, I just checked this morning, I feel like most of the bigger indices, they haven't come down significantly. Like it's not like this huge correction that has happened yet. So volatility has increased. We have a war, pressure is up on oil prices. So a whole bunch of things are happening. So maybe before we get into the weeds of it all, can you kind of give us your 30,000 view perspective of what's happening here at the onset?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I see this as a continuation of some of the caution and some of the alarm bells that I raised back in late September and early October on that call with you. What I saw back then at that point in time was really just the initiation of something that could have been bigger, but at the time it looked like it could just be a very normal course correction. As time has gone on and we've seen more and more data come through over the last 6 months, my caution has increased a lot. I've made moves in the portfolio here to be more defensive and really in anticipation of something that I think is now evolving into something much bigger. I see now still the potential for upwards of a 15% correction equity markets. And then the longer term view now is that this could potentially morph into something even bigger, right? And we can go through some of the ideas there and some of my thinking on these ideas. But really now, what I'm anticipating even in the short term is kind of more of a substantial move than I had even found myself thinking about 6 months ago.
How has like the whole war and geopolitics changed your picture or your view? I mean, in the end, I guess you were already sort of cautious right before it, as you just said, you know, but things are only kind of exacerbated by this. Or yeah, what is your view on geopolitics nowadays?
Yeah, so as we were going through October, November, I was already looking at the potential for higher energy prices. And I've been writing about that in my monthly commentaries. And what I saw back then was that we had oil supplies were essentially at a glut level, okay, and that we are potentially, I was looking at ideas like shut-ins and things like that. Like we were already so full with storage. We had floating storage that was pretty much maxed out. And then I saw this kind of encroaching, looming presence of geopolitical pressures coming. Like I did not anticipate that this would necessarily be Venezuela and then Iran exactly the way it happened. But the conditions were there that supported this bigger picture view. The fact that we're here now with a looming energy crisis on our hands, regardless of what happens over the next 2 weeks in regard with this idea of a ceasefire or not, and maybe there is one, maybe there isn't one, we don't really know how many ships are going through on a daily basis. I mean, we can track stuff, but that's only tracking like the lit responders. You don't really even know how many ships are going untracked through there. There's a lot of uncertainty around this whole idea, right? And the idea that these energy prices can be very impactful to the consumer, even if we get a resolution in Iran, like has there already been enough damage done to various energy supply chain upstream, downstream kind of places? Does the U.S. consumer, can the U.S. consumer recover from that even if we get a resolution in the short term? I don't know, right? It looks to me, my hunch is that that doesn't happen. It looks to me like there's already too much set in motion and there's already enough weak points in consumer data that I'm seeing that regardless of what happens in Iran in the short term, we are already on a path to, let's call it a contracting economy. I don't know if the word recession is appropriate yet, but we are on the path to that place if things don't change quickly.
What is it that you're looking at if you look at the consumer? You know, what type of data is what you're looking at and is telling you that things have been deteriorating? Can you zero in on that?
So I think the top line ideas of retail sales is a really easy place to start that conversation, right? So in nominal terms, retail sales have been doing okay, right? And prices are going up and people are paying more for these things. Okay, that's fine. However, in real terms, so inflation adjusted, consumer sales, retail data is actually going down, about 2% year over year. If you want to just zero in on retail sales out of broader data, that's actually down 2.5% year over year. So I'm looking at there, I'm looking at like the Fiserv small business reporting that comes out monthly. And we're seeing there that inflation adjusted sales are down, transaction volumes are down. So people are spending more for less stuff. Okay, so that's not really indicative of growing demand in this economy. It's actually the opposite, right? So what we're seeing here is that consumers are paying up more for less stuff. I think that we're finally starting to see a little bit of upside right now in consumer credit data, right? And some people are interpreting this as the beginning of a new cycle, right? Like, oh, look, consumers are borrowing again. Unfortunately, I don't really think they're borrowing for the right reason. They're not borrowing because they have some big demand out there in the future. They're borrowing because prices are going up, okay? And they have to buy certain things. They have to buy necessities in order to live their lives. Seeing this big increase in demand for discretionary goods and consumer credit is going to fulfill that need. This is kind of like desperation type of credit increase, if I can put it that way. And so that doesn't leave me with this like glowing feeling that the economy is recovering. If anything, this looks to me very similarly to what we see in typical late cycle economic environments, right? And the issue there is we really haven't seen one of those late cycle economic environments for about 20 years. Like the last real one of those was 2007, going into 2008, like going into March 2008 specifically. So this memory is so distant for a lot of practitioners, a lot of investors, and for some people, it's a completely new idea that I think this data is very easily being misinterpreted unless you have that expertise and unless you were around back then to kind of live through it and understand the data for what it really is.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel that you point to. I mean, that's exactly right. A lot of people have probably not experienced this. Myself, I'm probably too young to kind of point back to that area and haven't been a practitioner back then. So that's certainly interesting to think about. I mean, in terms of the consumer, I've also heard that, as you said, you know, they're tapping into credit just because they kind of have to because of rising prices. They're tapping into their own savings. I think that's also what we've been seeing, that the saving rate has been coming down, which can only go on for so long, I guess. The consumer sentiment overall seems to be not good, but this has been going on for quite some time. My question that I'm asking myself is this just now exacerbating the whole situation because like a lot of people are expecting higher inflation coming out of this geopolitical war situation and only further down the road might it then kind of create the disinflationary aspects because higher oil prices weigh on economic activity? Or how do you think about this? It's like, it's really putting more oil into the fire in that sense when it comes to consumer sentiment, right?
Yeah, well put, Pascal. So I do share that view. I think that the rise in energy prices that we're seeing right now is ultimately disinflationary, to put it lightly, and it could be outright contractionary, depending on how long this could go on for. Where I do want to be very careful about is that I don't see this as being inflationary in the actual technical sense of the word. It is inflationary, like in the colloquial sense, like the newspaper may report this as inflation. But when oil prices go up, this is actually just an increase in the price level. This isn't really inflation in the true kind of monetary sense that I think about it. And so from that point of view, an increase in the price level can very easily cut into consumer demand, which could potentially lead into recession and outright contraction, depending on how consumers can handle this and how long this goes on for, right? So if we can go through a short period of time and consumers take on some credit, and then there's an actual resolution, we're okay. We can make it through it in that case. However, I don't see that as being like my base case, at least. I think that this looks like it's going to go on for a little bit longer. You know, this isn't just USA versus Iran. There are other parties in this geopolitical mix that may have differing objectives. And this isn't, in my opinion, going to be a tidy resolution. I think there's a lot of downstream activity that comes out of this conflict. There's a lot of other bigger picture conflicts involved. And so this is going to take a little bit more than, a 10-point plan to work out. Now, just one thing that I want to sort of circle back to you, if you'll let me, is we can look at the consumer level of things. But if you want to take it up a level, I think that it's really interesting to look at ISM services, right? Services take up 70% of the US GDP. And ultimately, a lot of this consumer spending has to do with that services reporting. Like that services, ISM services will help us understand what the consumers are doing, right? And so in that light, services PMI put up a really good number a month ago. This current month, not so good. But some people are interpreting this because we're seeing new orders go up as again, the kind of incoming of a new economic cycle. And again, unfortunately, this to me looks more like late cycle activity, right? So let me recap exactly how that works. Okay. So first off, the headline number kind of decreased a little bit, but was up last month. So, okay. So we're kind of in this like up, but down kind of bigger picture. Underneath the headline, right? New orders are up. Business activity is down. Backlogs are up. All right. Supplier deliveries are getting slower. And ultimately, employment is down. So this is a very unique combination. You don't see this a lot, right? And so in my opinion, what is happening here is that we have a system, the services system in total is kind of reaching its capacity. And when it reaches capacity, we are not seeing these companies reach out in turn to increase the capacity. Usually what happens in a new economic cycle is demand increases. And then in response, businesses start to increase their capacity to service that demand, right? They start employing people, they start building a capacity to do that. However, we're seeing the opposite right now. Okay, businesses are not increasing employment, they're dropping employment. And what that is causing is a backlog to increase because these new orders that are coming in are not being processed at the same rate as they were previously. And that is now causing the system to start getting jammed up. And that is the explanation of what we're seeing in the PMI reports. That is where the supplier deliveries are getting jammed up and they're taking longer. Now, to take it a level further, you want to look at, okay, so there is this new order thing, right? So new orders are up. Isn't that a good thing? Where are the new orders up? And where that new order activity is happening is that's being concentrated in like financial sector, okay, and real estate and professional services. That's where the new orders are. Okay. The new orders are not building up in retail, and they're certainly not building up in trucking. So what's happening here is the capital flows through the economy, the last place that they all tend to line up and really start to amplify is in the financial services sector. That's where we're seeing the new orders, right? That's where the lending growth is happening because we're now at the end of the cycle where you need more lending to sustain your rate of spend. Okay. And when you look at retail and you see the new orders are actually falling down and employment's down, and then you look at trucking and you see that employment is down there, this is the opposite of a new economic cycle. They're not building up new capacity for future demand. They're letting this current demand that we have been on the back of since COVID times, this is now the final stage of it. It's now petering out, and we're not going to increase capacity to service it because there's nothing behind it. So we're going to let this thing, play out through the economy. And then there's very little left behind it in terms of new genuine activity from early cycle sources.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes. Now, is ISM prices paid? Is that related to what you're saying as well? Because that's what I've been seeing is kind of upticking quite significantly as well, which could only mean, okay, you know, higher prices need to be paid. But then this is not necessarily because of like demand is accelerating, just because the system in and of itself is tight. And that's why prices are higher. Is that sort of the connection there as well? And then also ISM manufacturing, a lot of people just like who look at this and, you know, are daily on X, they're looking at these numbers. They say, okay, you know, March has come higher in than the forecast kind of had it. Is all of this sort of related, you know, that you have to look under the hood instead of just at the actual numbers in the way that you were just explaining it, you know?
That's exactly it. I think that you really need to look under the hood beyond the headline data. So a lot of prices up over the last little while. Look, it's undeniable that this is from energy prices increasing, okay? Like there's a massive component there that is related to energy prices up, okay? And if we want to look at a very similar dynamic, I would invite everybody to look at what's happening January through March of 2008, okay? That's when the last time we saw this really huge oil spike into the end of cycle, very similar kind of characteristics right now. ISM doing the very similar things back then to what it's doing right now. We look even to the point of how that was affecting, like how an increase in energy prices affects logistics and trucking through a system, okay? So the types of things that are responding to energy up right now are exactly the same things that were responding to energy up in 2008, right? So you see increases in grain, you're seeing increases in chemicals shipping. Intermodal still kind of like in this like waffly zone where nothing's really happening, right? Retailers aren't massively stocking goods. You know, it just so happened that as we came off this like tariff-induced stocking that was going on through all 2025, or sorry, the early part of 2025, and then through 2025, you're working through these inventories and inventory costs were rising. And it prompted a lot of retailers to go back to just-in-time inventory. You know, this is where like you're not carrying huge amounts of inventory, you're going to whittle things down. And it just so happens that by the time you get back to this kind of just-in-time inventory idea in like February 6, you start to get an energy price increase. And what's the thing that really breaks just-in-time inventory? Just-in-time inventory relies on cheap energy prices to keep moving things around. And if you have a big increase in that, then you're going to mess up your whole supply chain that is reliant upon low energy prices. So I think that component is still to bleed through, and we're just going to see that coming out of March and April data as that part of it plays through the consumer pocketbooks.
But how long do you think will this take to kind of bleed through? You know, like could this be going on, and could we be seeing like these ISM figures just come in elevated still for the next couple of months? Or do you think at some point, obviously, they will have to kind of break and something will have to break or have to give? And it will be, in your view, I guess, these like sort of ISM numbers and PMI and everything that still somewhat looks as if it were in an expansionary sort of environment, but it will have to give. But for how long can this kind of go on? You know, this discrepancy, I guess, or dichotomy that's showing in the data, so to say.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And so you mentioned something a little while ago that I think is really interesting. And that was you noted the ongoing declines in net private saving. Okay. So net private saving has been going down for a very long time. Okay. That's not a secret. It's kind of like just the way the economy works now. But the big change between 2007 and now, in terms of this kind of late stage cycle, is private saving has been negative or trending into negative territory only recently. Like if we rewind the clock 20 years ago, we still had positive savings, right? Substantially. Now we are like, we've been trending into negative zone. And what that's telling us is that there's not a lot of cushion left in terms of savings, right? So now we automatically go into debt mode to service this thing. Okay. So if prices are going up, we have to take on debt. There's not a lot of savings to access to address this increasing cost. The problem there is now we are seeing credit issues evolving out of AI and bleeding out through the rest of the banking sector, We're seeing high yield spreads open up, for example. And for how long can the banking sector support lending as we are going into a more, let's call it a stressful environment for lending? Okay. Like, we're not quite there yet. We're beyond the point of no return. I don't mean to say that we are, but we are on the way there. And I don't think it's going to take a lot more to start seeing more pullbacks in credit. In fact, I already think we're kind of in that zone. Despite what I've said earlier about consumer credit kind of ticking up here, I think more broadly, I think we are entering a place where we could potentially start to see credit start to contract, right? One of the places that credit has been growing the most over the last number of years is in non-depository financial institutions. So this is a very fancy, long-winded way of saying asset managers, private credit, all these kind of related entities under this umbrella. One of the things that kind of spurred all this was that it was actually like cheaper for banks from a capital ratios and safety perspective to lend to these asset managers instead of making these loans themselves. Like, it's quite expensive to lend directly. And so there's less of a capital charge to lend to these private institutions and let them do the secondary stage of lending into these actual companies. They do all the credit work. And so there's this incentive structure that the banks are incentivized to lend to these asset managers. And then the asset managers themselves are incentivized to put these loans out, right? Like, they get the fees, they get the securitization, all that kind of stuff happens downstream from there. That has kind of resulted in this like 25, 30% something year over year growth in that sector of lending. And I think that just now, over the last number of weeks, we are starting to see, in my opinion, that rate of growth is starting to plateau. Okay. Now, that could plateau and then head higher, maybe, but given what I'm seeing broadly in terms of what's happening in private credit, what's happening in AI CapEx meme build out, this kind of leads me to believe that this may be indicative of the top here and that we may continue to see that growth rate slow down. And so we are still seeing inflows into this stuff, but the pace of that is slowing, right? So, looking at the derivative of it, so that would be the first indication of a change in the character of that market. And the other thing too that's important to think about here is, because of these incentive structures, we should not necessarily expect that these entities want to take a mark on their books, meaning that if these loans are going bad, these entities that have made these loans are incentivized not to acknowledge that, to kick the can down the road, to take payment in kind instead of payment in cash. And that even extends up to the bank level, where to keep the marks on the bank's books, they may continue lending to these NDFIs, even if we start to see deterioration in those entities. They still may be receiving cash just to keep the mark alive, just to keep something alive on the book. That doesn't preclude the idea that there's contagion spreading through the system, but that contagion is being kind of camouflaged in a way.
Maybe just to summarize what you just told me in my own words. So like, as you said, you know, there's been this lending going on through this sort of intermediary sort of actor, you know, who's been these private credit funds and stuff, just because they did sort of regulatory arbitrage also to the benefits of banks. And now, is this also related, obviously, to the news and headlines that we've been hearing about, like these redemptions that, you know, couldn't be serviced, you know, and that a lot of these like bigger private credit firms and also private equity firms kind of, yeah, had some pressure on them. And then they couldn't kind of, honor, you know, the commitments that they made. And because the liquidity wasn't there in some sense. Is that related to what you're telling us here?
Yeah, it is related. I just want to be very careful, because a lot of these firms, it's not that they're not honoring the commitments that they made, because the prospectuses were quite clear about what would require a gating, right? And these, or what would prevent redemptions, right? So everybody's just playing by the rules that they signed up for. It's just, I think that many of the people that invested in these products, perhaps they didn't take enough consideration about the underlying liquidity of what they thought they were purchasing versus what the actual asset, the nature of the actual asset they're purchasing, right? So there's a mismatch that's playing out there. However, that doesn't detract from the fact that there are contagion and there's problems spreading. I mean, when increasingly we see more of these funds starting to limit redemption activity, that is a problem in itself, right? Like that's just kind of contagion spreading and things are freezing up. Like, again, to go back to the 2007 example, like asset-backed commercial paper, this was stuff that was supposed to be safe and liquid, and that just instantly froze. This isn't quite, the expectation wasn't supposed to be that this was quite that liquid, right? That's kind of a different level of liquidity, that ABCP stuff. But I think that retail investors, the marketing that came along with a lot of these products maybe didn't emphasize this idea enough that there could be liquidity problems if there was a large amount of redemptions come.
Yeah, that's a good point to point out. And it's exactly right that sometimes it was marketed as being just as liquid maybe as public markets, but by definition, obviously, it can't be as liquid because otherwise it wouldn't be sort of a private vehicle.
Now, one of the things that I am watching quite closely is that some of these funds, not all of them, did have sleeves of public market debt alongside private market debt, and the public market sleeve was meant to provide that liquidity. However, if we are now seeing these larger redemptions happening, it's that's the contagion channel right there where the private market part of it freezes. Therefore, the asset manager has to start selling out on the public market stuff. The public market stuff can get into this kind of forced selling regime, and that's unfortunately where we could see this thing escalate or amplify into something much bigger. Now, we're not there yet, but this is one of the channels that I'm watching for if we could get there, right? So that's why things like some of the bonds that end up or credits that end up in ETF structures are really important to be watching right now, because that's that conduit, right? The stuff that's liquid is the stuff that could potentially take the brunt of the selling, while the private stuff just gets locked. Right. So that's the thing that you want to be keeping an eye on right now.
Yeah. That's also quite interesting to know. Yeah, exactly. One other thing that I'd like to get your take on, because some people have been saying, look, I hear you, Ben, that's totally right what you're telling me. But then again, there are these other sort of leading indicators like credit spreads. I think you mentioned them or brought them up as well. But then they're saying, look, they're barely above 300 basis point by now, so it's historically still tight. If you look at all these different financial stress indices that are out there, they're basically still at zero. So shouldn't they be kind of signaling more stress if there really was stress under the hood? You know, what do you say to these arguments? Or points.
Yeah, look, I see the same data everybody else does, but all of these things have to start somewhere, right? Like you don't get to massive credit spreads overnight. Like it all starts building from a certain place, and you start to see the trending behavior of those spreads opening up. You start to see the trending behavior within volatility. You start to see the trending behavior within market decline. Like all these things start to come together, and it's only in that last little moment that you start to see everything blow out. But all those blowouts start from things that are on the other side of things that are slowly building together to kind of weave this all into one big thing, right? So I do think that's kind of, we're on that road. And I don't mean to suggest this is anywhere near at the end of that road. I think we're still kind of at the beginning of it. That also means that there is time. There are things that can be done to relieve some of the stresses so that we go back entirely to a more normal functioning economy. But I just don't see those things aren't happening right now. Like we're still on this road toward that place.
No, that's definitely interesting. Maybe I'd be interesting. Do you see a possibility for a like future melt up to be happening before everything sort of, and now it's maybe a little doomsday talking here, but it collapses, you know, in the sense of like, yeah, there is the possibility that things will melt up first before they melt down. And some people have been making the argument that they're seeing real rates, you know, I don't know if that's a concept that you're following as well, is kind of making new lows across the curve, you know, and that's why liquidity could be amplified in the system and helping to maybe have us see this kind of melt up phase before everything then kind of goes the other way. Do you see that as a possibility? Especially, I think we mentioned consumer sentiment, you know, and I feel like I just saw that consumer inflation expectation also jumped, obviously, because of what we've been talking. And then if you factor in that there's still this sort of Trump guy, Warsh, who might be coming into the office, you know, that he wants to pause interest rates, maybe not bring it down anymore. But then, you know, you have higher nominal interest rates while inflation is higher. While nominal rates stay put, then obviously you get lower real rates, you know, and that could be supportive of liquidity in the system. So what do you think about this? Is this something you're looking at all, and do you see this possibility for a melt up happening before we see it rolling over really?
So I think the most direct way to address that is to take it from the view of like an equity market meltdown, right? I think that's kind of what you're getting at here, right? And so, look, I'm not opposed to the idea of the market coming back to all-time highs. I think it would be extremely difficult for that to happen, but I'm not opposed to the idea of that being within the realm of possibilities, okay? I do not see the market making new all-time highs quite yet or extending into something where we really start pushing up well higher. If we go back to those October highs where I initially said, like, this is the market top, like, that was my call back then, was like, we're not going to move significantly higher from October, late October. And we haven't, you know, even January extended just a blip above and then came off. We'll see that as being an ultimately very hard ceiling to crack. Now, in the short term right here, you know, we're Friday, April 10th today, right? And so markets have just kind of gone through this 7% in 7 days thing that everybody seems to be really excited about, okay? And we're now kind of knocking up against that JP Morgan collar strike here. And I think that's going to provide a lot of temporary, like, shorter term resistance. Like that thing's in play until the end of June, right? June 30th. And so as S&P 500 kind of moves up to around this level, 68.40, 68.5-ish level, dealers have to start selling futures to kind of hedge their own positioning on all of this. And that makes this kind of a bit of a ceiling, or at least let's call it resistance, and it makes it very hard to cross. It's not impossible. Like price can move over it. You can get an announcement tomorrow that just opens well over it, and then you could keep going. But for now, this is kind of like marking like a very temporary like resistance zone that would be hard to get through. Now, the thing is that, you know, if we rewind back to about a month ago, my view was that we would see the market decline into mid-April. And I thought that what was possible was like 6,000 on the S&P, 5,800 on the S&P. And that from that level, we would then spend June, or we'd spend May and June bouncing into this collar strike and then kind of capping off there. What actually happened was the market fell and then immediately rebounded now right into this collar level. And so I think now that time frame has kind of been pushed forward. Now that we're already at this collar level, we could kind of stick around here for the next 2 months. Would be weird, and that would be very hard to do from like a feeling about like how momentum in markets work. Like, it'd be very hard to get sticky right here after everything we've just seen. So I think that we're now kind of exhausted this kind of short-term thing, and we may be at a point where this is the first real bear market rally we've seen, like 7% in 7 days, which would be historically in keeping with what it kind of looks like when you get that very first bear market rally. Before it's even called a bear market, you get that first big drop, like, you know, 7 to 10%-ish, and then it really quickly rebounds. That's kind of exactly what we've just seen. And if this continues to act as resistance, you could, in fact, be moving lower back to that 6,000 level, 5,800 level, where there seems to be some more mechanical support, I'll put it, where there you could get down there and then start to see some more forced mechanical buy, right? You do still have the JP Morgan strike on the bottom end with the put. We'll see how that plays out, whether that becomes an accelerant or not when we get there. But for now, at least, that's my view at this point in time. Longer term, going into the end of this year, there's still quite a bit of fog in the air, right? If we start to see a larger fiscal response, like right now, fiscal is down somewhere around 11-12% year over year in terms of adding net private assets into the net assets into the private sector. Okay, fiscal is putting less money into the households and companies, okay, than it was last year in terms of the rate of growth. Right, so that's kind of been this like contractionary kind of flow effect. Right, that contractionary flow, if it continues, could really start to impact lending and the rest of the economy. That could take this market much lower if that continues, right? We're not there yet, right? We have to let that play out and see how that works. If we start to see a lot more fiscal spending, right? If we start to see a response from fiscal, maybe that's on the back of more geopolitical action. Maybe we need more soldiers and we need to pay them more. Maybe that's some sort of response to a midterm election season that's coming up and we need to goose the economy for that. Like, I don't know. We'll see what could potentially cause that. But if that fiscal starts to respond in a more positive way and we start to see more positive acceleration there, then you could set up for a rally bounce that could take us into well into over new highs into the end of the year. So that's where there's still a question. That's where 2026 is really about being a more tactical kind of year. You know, like 2025, you just have to make one big decision. In April, all you had to do was buy and sit back and relax. And that was kind of obvious to me, at least from the start. 2026 is a year, in my opinion, where you have to be a lot more tactical with things, and you really have to have your finger on the trigger in order to make it through a year that could be very choppy with a lot more volatility to it.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Regarding the liquidity spigot, you know, I have some more questions, but I want to put them off for later. I also want to focus and dig a little deeper into the market mechanics, you know, that you were just referencing with this sort of call wall as well, and how we have to think about this. But maybe before I ask these questions, one last sort of devil's advocate thing I want to bring up, you know, because we were talking about this last time. I remember in October when you were referencing these garbage stocks, you know, that kind of were sort of going up, and some people were saying, okay, look, this doesn't seem to be the case when we're rolling over. Now, again, people are still pointing to stuff like the Russell 3000, you know, who's been kind of holding its longer term trend and beginning to bid off the lows here. And so the question to me is, again, you know, some people are saying if we were in the process of moving into a bear market, we wouldn't see these low quality sectors beginning to grind higher, you know. But I guess you have another explanation for this as well, right? Why this might be the case. Or, I mean, nowadays, everyone seems to be just looking at one data point or one thing and then trying to justify why this can't be happening. So I guess you're trying to put together the pieces one by one. But how would you counteract such a point, you know, with the Russell 3000 and the sort of low small cap stocks?
I think that watching small caps rally right here is exactly the sign of a bear market rally. This is exactly what you would see if that were happening. And now let me explain to you exactly how that works. So back when we chatted in October, I noted that garbage stocks were rallying. And nobody was talking about that at the time. Everybody thought that this was kind of this like reflation meme idea. And what I had proposed at the time was happening beneath the surface was that we were seeing institutional level degrossing, right? So just putting the mosaic together, that looked to me like we saw very large equity funds, very large multi-strategy funds degrossing their books. So selling their longs and buying back their shorts, right? Going into Q3 of 2025, these firms had put on a record amount of leverage. And this was like long leverage. They were just levered to the upside, and they had a lot of shorts against that as well. But directionally, they were long. Okay, so nets were up and gross was up. And moving into that period, we started to see Mag 7 starting to get hit. Right, so that was going down. So longs were dropping, and a lot of the garbage small cap Russell stuff was moving up, and it was all moving up together. Okay, usually the garbage stuff moves up idiosyncratically because of individual company announcements and M&A activity and things like that, and resolutions to problems, but it was all moving up together. So super classic sign when you see longs down, shorts up, people are degrossing. And then the data comes out, and I would specifically point to the SEC Form PF data. So every quarter, these hedge funds, the very large hedge funds, have to report their certain metrics to the SEC. The SEC aggregates this data, obviously after the fact, and then lets you see it. And lo and behold, when we get the data reports for Q3, that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing that degrossing happening, right? So what happened after that? Okay, so moving into Q4, and I think into Q1, what we saw was that nets were reduced, but gross came back up. So what that is telling you is that these funds, instead of taking directional exposure back to further upside for the S&P 500, what they did instead was they went more to a market neutral positioning or a low beta positioning. So they increased their shorts by a very large amount, and they kind of kept their longs where they're at. And the books on an aggregate level were pretty well balanced, right? So there wasn't a lot of directional exposure to the market. And lo and behold, the market kind of ticks sideways and these guys are making money. And okay, that's how that happened. That, like, it's a very simple explanation, right? But now we get into March. We get into a situation where now you're starting to see volatility starts to rise. Contagion starts to spread. VAR limits are getting hit with software stocks coming out of January. And as we head down into the end of March, a lot of those shorts are now looking pretty good on that match book, right? On the market neutral books, those shorts are looking pretty juicy, right? Going into the depths of the end of March, you start to see some short cover, right? That short covering, in my opinion, is exactly what has resulted in the last 10 days now, in terms of the 7% in 7 days thing. You're looking at the stuff that's rallied, right? A lot of this looks like short covering. You're looking at some of these secondary indicators, so stuff like TRIN, or sometimes called like the ARMS index. So you look at advancing stocks versus declining stocks, divided by advancing volume, divided by declining volume. Well, really wonky kind of stuff, but this is all kind of supporting the view, right? So if you're seeing more volume in declining stocks than you're seeing in rising stocks, and you're rising 7% in a few weeks, this is all very indicative. This is all very classic bear market stuff. You don't really see a lot of that outside of bear market activity. When you see very large moves coming out of bottoms, and these are long-term tradable bottoms, you start to see like bread thrusts, like really hard kind of like unmistakable signals of strength. And that's just not, like, we still haven't seen that. That's not showing up yet. So in my opinion, the fact that we've seen this rally over the last 7 days is not indicative that we're going to go back to all-time highs. It's actually, in my opinion, really characteristic of the first types of rallies that you see in larger bear markets.
So interesting. I think what you've just elaborated on really feeds well, very well, into one of your latest market commentaries. You know, the April 2026 update, you had this one sentence that I want to quote. In your own words, you wrote, like, understanding market plumbing and how positioning, funding, and hedging interact is essential to managing risk in the current environment. Can you maybe elaborate on this further? I mean, from what I get, it's really that you need to, again, pull back the curtain and you have to look under the hood and see, okay, these are the dynamics that are just going on because the market today functions like this. And this can then help you explain stuff that kind of looks counterfactual or contrary to a lot of arguments out there. So yeah, if you were so kind to kind of do a quick deep dive there as well, that would be great.
Yeah, I'd love to get into that, because I think it's one of the most important things that people are missing right now about this market, right? So look, everybody is kind of raised in this idea that markets work on cash flow evaluation, and everybody's read security analysis and all the Buffett notes. And I'm not trying to suggest that that stuff doesn't work anymore, because in the big picture, there are still those dynamics at play, okay? But what I think people are missing, or that people need to be made more aware of, is the rising impact of what passive investing has done to markets, and how passive investing has changed the plumbing of the markets and made the markets more sensitive to certain things that it wasn't necessarily so sensitive to 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, okay? So what I mean by that is we've seen this rise in passive investing, where now passive activity kind of accounts for somewhere between 50, 55% of daily activity on the market. What that means, if you're not passive, is that there is a shrinking pool of liquidity that is available to active managers, okay? Because if all of these flows are ending up in passive, there's less and less flow that is going into the other parts of the market on a relative basis. If there is less flow going into those parts of the market, it can make those parts of the market more susceptible to volatility, okay? So a really good way to look at this is just in the recent endeavor. I think this kind of caught a lot of people off guard, where if we go back to January to February, mid-February, we saw this really big rise in consumer staples stocks. Okay, so at that point in time, let's just kind of set the table. Mag 7 was already dropping, you know, off 10, 15%, or a little bit more in some cases. And everybody was kind of taking notice of this. Software stocks, which were kind of the next level down on the hierarchy of what funds own, was starting to drop. So contagion was bleeding through the hierarchy of fund holdings. And now they're starting to see forced selling in software stocks and quality stocks and financials. These are all kind of factor related at that level. And so when your risk manager starts to see those factors going, you get a tap on the shoulder, you have to reduce size, and that's kind of what starts bleeding out. And then you start to look at the smaller parts of the S&P 500 hierarchy, and they're kind of flattish at the time, or not flattish, but they're just not moving as much, okay? And so, okay, if you're going to be very opportunistic and very active about things, you can now hide out there, or you can rotate some capital there in the short term. But the issue is that things like consumer staples, because they're so low on the hierarchy, you know, staples, it's only like, what, 5.5% of the overall S&P 500 weight. You're going to start to move those stocks a lot if you start to plug a lot of money there. Okay. And that's exactly what we saw. We saw staples starting to run, right? So you start to see these things trending, stair-stepping higher on a daily basis. And then as this, the overall selling starts to really overwhelm through the hierarchy, it starts to hit staples. And then staples just kind of like elevators down through this thing because there's no liquidity on the bid side. Okay. So all this, it's taking in flows and these things are happy to take in flows. But when you try to, once things start hitting VAR limits, it's everybody out at the same time. And because there's no more active flow to catch that bid, you're going to get these big volatility events happening in the lower parts of the S&P 500 liquidity spectrum. I think that we are kind of starting to see that right now with some of the energy companies, right? So staples was 5.5% of the index. Energy from the S&P 500 level is only like 3.5. It's like 3.3 or something, okay? So that's like an order from a flow perspective, from a liquidity perspective, that's like an order of magnitude lower liquidity. So you don't need a lot of money going into energy sector stocks in order to move the energy sector significantly hot, right? And that's kind of what we're seeing right now. The problem there is that unless we continue to see higher and higher energy prices, which, okay, that could happen. But unless we continue to see that, if those energy prices start to fall, you could see very big drops happening in these energy sector names, okay, because of that liquidity factor and because the market plumbing itself is very different than it was 20 years ago. Okay.
Yes. So interesting. And in terms of when we focus on the part, how positioning, funding and hedging sort of interact, I mean, is this then also feeding into this thing that you mentioned with the dealer's call wall, you know, with this sort of thing that's kind of capping, you know, the upside by now? Or I mean, help me understand this, because this is something I'm still a total rookie when it comes to options and not a practitioner. So how does it, I've just been reading about like dealers are apparently sitting on this $13 billion in positive gamma at sort of this price level, you know, a call wall. And that's why every rally gets mechanically sold back down. Like, maybe you can explain the mechanics of this better than obviously I can. But I guess this is also feeding into how markets today kind of work with all these options and just a derivative market that's out there and that can really yank things around mm-hmm. in that sense.
Yeah, so one of the key things that are happening here, and I'll get to the dealer hedging component in a second, but one of the key things that are happening here is that if liquidity starts to contract, in my opinion, this makes these other effects show up more, right? So if we have less fundamental investors that are willing to sit on bids and willing to do that kind of fundamental investing work, then passive capital is kind of sort of trapped. It doesn't respond to this stuff. And that means that the flows now are coming disproportionately from things like CTA moving around, CTA positioning moving around, trend fall, like this, like essentially trend falling moving around, and then options positioning can inform a greater amount of what's actually happening in the markets. Okay, so look, options positioning can really change on a day to day basis. So I don't want, like, it's April 10th right now, 11:30 in the morning. I don't want to sort of give a call on what I think is going to do, because it can literally change based on what's happening on 0-day options activity, like from today to tomorrow. Like it can be very sensitive. And so that's where I find that the options, what's happening in the options market is useful on like a day-to-day basis. And it's useful if you see really, really huge clusters of particular activity, but it's not necessarily going to tell you what's going to happen next week, for example, unless you're approaching one of these call wall situations or big put strike or something like that. Okay. So it has a place and it is informative, but it's not going to give you the complete picture. I just want to be clear about that part. Okay. But okay, beyond that, when there are large options positions being put on, dealers who are on the other side of those trades, their job is just to provide that option to you as a buyer or seller. Okay. They're not there taking the directional view opposing to you. Like that's not their business. They're there to sell you this thing. They're going to make, you know, money off of taking bid-ask spreads on this stuff. And then they're going to turn around and they're going to hedge their own positioning so that they are not exposed to the other side of your trade necessarily. Okay. Now, this all kind of filters out to where there's a point of once all the positions are netted out against each other, there is this kind of residual position. And it's that residual position that they're hedging against. And the thing is, is their hedging has to follow a very mechanical kind of rules-based approach if they want to maintain their hedge, right? They can't just start hedging in this kind of like willy-nilly sense where they're kind of going, they're putting their fingers in the air and saying, oh, I think this is how I have to hedge. They are responding to very specific rules in how they have to keep their hedges on. And that's just because of the very sensitivities in the options market. You know, you have delta, you have gamma, there's some charm, you have vanna. So options respond very specifically to things that are happening in the equity markets and volatility. And so dealers have to in turn respond to that and hedge their own books in a very predictable way. And it's those predictable flows that help inform kind of people who are watching this stuff very closely what could potentially happen that day or within the next few days, or how the market could potentially respond to moving towards key levels where there's a lot of options positioning on the books.
Okay, I see. Yeah, that's interesting. I want to come back to this one point about passive flows that you mentioned, you know, because you said something about if liquidity is getting thinner, then obviously other things can become more pronounced. But then maybe as a layman again, me and others might be asking, okay, but isn't passive flow by definition that they're passive and that they just keep going on, you know, and it just come through all these institutional investors, you know, who just deploy no matter what. So are we seeing that these kind of recede already or like, yeah, help me understand this, because like some people might be arguing that's exactly the case why we have passive flows nowadays. People just deploy money no matter what, you know. Maybe they kind of go back once the equity markets have receded 20%, but now they probably are still going hard. So like, do we see this coming down in any sense or?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting dynamic to look at very closely, right? So passive investing, even right now, even in the midst of equities down, continue to receive inflows, right? You're right that a certain percentage of people's paychecks get automatically rebalanced into these passive investment products, no matter what has happened, okay? And so that makes passive particularly sensitive to things like employment, right? Because employment is the mechanism by which those flows get delivered in passive. And then passive actually is very sensitive at a bigger level to the flow itself, right? So the only thing that can keep passive growing is if it keeps receiving inflows, right? And so where are those inflows coming from, okay? And this is the point where I think that we can tie passive back into what's happening in credit markets and what's happening in the fiscal space, is that if we are seeing a year-over-year negative growth rate in fiscal, that's less flow, that's less incremental flow. That means there's less incremental flow going to private sector. That means potentially there's less incremental flow going into passive. Now, the other mechanism here that's important is like, okay, well, credit's been expanding this whole time. What about that money? Well, if we want to examine the AI CapEx meme, right? That money that's going into credit is not necessarily going into the passive flow structure, right? So if you're talking about $600 billion that's supposed to be going into AI spending, that money is not being reinvested domestically. Okay, maybe like 30 billion of that is going into like the actual construction of data centers and HVAC and electrical and that kind of stuff. But by and large, most of that money is being spent on computer chips, and those computer chips are being imported from Southeast Asia, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and that money is leaving the US and it's getting parked out there. And so that money does not get recycled back into the U.S. economy where it can go back into passive flows and support employment and all this kind of good stuff that was supposed to happen with the AI CapEx build-out. That's kind of how it was marketed. That money all left the country, right? And when you buy imports, when you buy equipment from other places, that's a negative to GDP. Like the GDP equation treats imports as a subtraction, okay? So that mechanically lowers your GDP. So this money is not being recycled internally to support this like passive domestic flow idea. And so that's that was kind of my bigger point, is that passive flows themselves are still positive, but I don't think that they're still at the same rate. And the easiest kind of way to find evidence of that is look at the Mag 7, right? In a true economic reflation, if we had increasing flows, where would that money end up from a market perspective?
Predominantly.
It would end up in Mag 7. It would end up in the most concentrated part of where those flows all come together. And yet we've seen the Mag 7 trade off 15, 20% in some cases over the last 3-4 months here. Okay.
Yeah,
if this was a real economic kind of moment where we were seeing reflation, et cetera, those companies should be on the receiving end of those incremental flows, and they're not. And that is the really big warning sign that people are missing. It's the fact that you have your market leaders that are still down and still not responding to this flow activity. That's your real signal.
Yeah, that's that. Intuitively, that makes a lot of sense. That's exactly right. Let me jump to another thing, and I know I might be jumping here and there, but I mean, you've also been all over volatility markets, you know, and pointing out that this upside momentum is steadily building. I read something, a pattern that has only previously appeared before the global financial crisis in 2007, you said. Like, where exactly is volatility building, and what are you checking to infer this? Is it mostly the VIX or the volatility of the VIX? Or I think I've seen you look at VIX divided by VIX 3-month volatility and like the different metrics and stuff that you're checking. That would be interesting to know.
Yeah, sure. So volatility is a really interesting kind of space to look at because it can really inform a lot of bigger picture market kind of views, right? So you're right. I look at a lot of different things when it comes to volatility. I look at VIX. I look at VIX futures, ratios of short-term volatility to longer-term volatility. That's the VIX to VIX 3M idea, 3-month idea. And just to start there, so what I've noticed over the last number of months is kind of a very new thing that's been happening in the volatility space. And that is that for 20 years, essentially, when we see volatility, we tend to see spikes in volatility. Right, volatility is a very concentrated, short-term, punctuated event where it happens and then it's over and then markets kind of resolve. What we've been seeing over the last several months is a steady building of volatility. So volatility itself looks like it is trending. Okay, so but by what I mean by that is it's been making higher highs and higher lows, right, over the last few months. Okay. That you could look at that in the VIX, you could look at that in VIX 3-month. There's a number of different ways you could see that. Correlation even will show you that, right? Like, so implied correlation is kind of looking at the same idea, a little bit of a different take on it or a different angle, but similar concept. But one of the places where this appears most clearly is if you look at VIX futures, right? So VIX futures, there's term structure, it's just a futures market like any other. It's just not super liquid, but it's still informative, okay? Like, it's not its own really big asset class at this point in time, but it looks like it could be on its way there, in my opinion. But anyways, what we're seeing inside of VIX futures is a steady accumulation of VIX futures by CTA, so trend followers, and by institutions, right? By asset managers and institutions. And again, it's been following the same pattern that like VIX has, where you start to see this very steady accumulation over time. Now, the only other place that we have seen this type of activity, again, is back in 2007, 2008, all right? Like, we don't have data that goes further back than that because VIX futures were like a relatively new product in the grand scheme of things. And even the flows can be very, like, it's a smaller market. But the fact that we're still starting to see these patterns play out, that we've seen a lot of these patterns, and the last time we've seen these patterns is 2007, 2008-ish, it's all kind of lining up in a certain direction. Like it's undeniable at this point, okay? So you have this kind of building upward, slow grinding momentum effect happening in that place. Now, the trouble happens when a lot of other trend followers and CTA start to attract to this idea. Okay. Like, I would make the case that right now we see a lot more momentum effects in markets. Like, momentum was certainly present throughout all of market activity. That's what the data shows. That's what the academic lit shows. But these days, I think that momentum plays a greater role actually in positioning. And because of the liquidity impacts that have been happening in the market because of passive, that short-term momentum can be more impactful. I think that's one of the reasons that we see more breadth thrust, for example, over the last number of years than we've seen historically. We've seen sharper V bottoms. Like, this is all because of these liquidity and momentum features that are coming out of this just positioning in the overall market. And so as this starts to grind into the volatility space, and volatility itself is not a super liquid place to put money, like buying VIX futures is not super liquid, even buying VIX calls are like really big spreads. You know, there's a lot of convexity in it, but it can be very expensive to put these positions on because there's wide bid-ask spreads and the rest of it. But as more capital accumulates in these places, you have this kind of squeeze effect that could take place, okay? Well, that flows into something with low liquidity, starts to crank up higher, What did we see in consumer staples? We saw a slow moving uptrend, okay, that then started to spiking into the end of it. What are we potentially going to see in energy here? Slow moving uptrend with some spiking, right? What could we see in VIX? If we start to see VIX futures continue this slow moving uptrend, burning higher, and then we start to really see spike activity, you could potentially get in a place where the tail starts to wag the dog and the VIX futures market and the rest of the volatility complex starts to tell the S&P what to do instead of the other way around. And when that starts to happen, when you start to see volatility spiking, that will bleed back through into how options dealers have to hedge. It'll bleed continually through CTAs. It'll bleed through these flows, and you could get into a very nasty vol event very quickly. So that's the kind of thing I'm watching out for right now as I'm seeing these similar patterns play out.
So interesting. Yeah, thanks a lot for putting out this information for me. At least it's very educational. Before finishing off here, you know, I'd like to maybe hark back to the liquidity situation with two more questions, you know. And I know one thing that you've also highlighted is that there's a decline happening in retail money market funds, you know, as a sort of a bad sign as well. I'd like to know more why this is the case or your reasoning behind this. And then maybe the last question would be also, you know, liquidity risk is sort of rising into April. We are in April now because of US tax season. What could come out of this? And is that another sort of explosive mix in the cocktail that we have right now, you know? So maybe these two questions to finish off, that would be amazing.
Yeah, sure. So what I've seen happening in money markets is essentially the growth in money markets has started to plateau over the last little while here, okay? Now, that's important because it shows that, okay, maybe a certain point of money market holders are accessing those savings, which kind of harkens back to something we talked about earlier in our call today, just drawing down those savings, okay, because savings, prices have gone up. That's also potentially impactful because we've seen a somewhat of a contraction in fiscal that's happening in terms of the rate of flow, and that's now coming into money markets where there's less money being put into the private sector. Potentially, that's what's happening in these retail money market funds. But then the other thing here that we have to keep in mind is that these retail money market funds are a really important part of the repo market. Okay, like there's a lot of leverage that gets that is enabled from the growth of these money market funds. And so if we're starting to see a plateau in these retail money market funds, then there is the potential that very recently, what this could mean is that there is less leverage available to the market, right? And that would make sense. Like if we're seeing this at the same time that we're seeing credit spreads open up, at the same time we're seeing volatility open up, it would make sense that there's less leverage available for funding for whatever financial markets positioning or people want to put on, right? So I think that that's something that's a developing story. That's something I'm watching. Now, the second part of your question here, that was really about short-term liquidity happening right now. Right now, reserves are up a little bit from where they were over the last few months. Reserve balances have come up a little bit here. And maybe that's because we're starting to see more tax refunds coming out. You know, 2026 was supposed to be a year where we're seeing more tax refunds. And maybe this has finally started to show up, okay? Like I was waiting for a while to watch this, and now we're finally starting to see some of it. I don't think it's anywhere to near the extent it was supposed to be, but okay, it's here. But one thing that is really interesting to me is that if you overlay like reserve balances and then you look at what happens to funding rates, and look, there's like a million different ways that you could look at funding rates, but a really simple one that you can do it yourself at home is you look at SOFR versus like secured overnight financing versus like effective funds, Fed funds rate or something like really super simple and generic. What you can see in doing that is that in times when reserve balances very suddenly drop, what tends to happen is you get a jump in SOFR. So you get a jump in like funding rates, okay? And again, different markets respond different ways, but on the whole, at an aggregate level, this happens. You can see this, okay? So why this is really important right now is that if we are now, so now we're in April where they're approaching this seasonal April tax drain. So everybody pays their taxes in April. When that happens, you tend to see a sudden drop in reserve balances. If you see a sudden drop in reserve balances, you could likewise, characteristically, you tend to see this increase in funding costs. And that could feed back into the bigger picture liquidity structure of fund positioning. So equity funds, multi-strategy funds, et cetera, that are reliant upon these funding costs. We'll have to see how this plays out. Like this isn't a slam dunk, but this is a potential channel through which we could see a renewal of volatility or a renewal of downside risk appear is that if you start to see more forced selling because people are very sensitive to leverage costs at this time, right? So that's the one thing that I'm watching for. That's going to be an active call over the month of April. We'll see how it plays out and whether or not that actually can kind of force a downside here.
Amazing. So great. Yeah. Hey, Ben, thanks a lot again for doing this. Also for zigzagging with me here and connecting the dots here and there. So that's been amazing. Already looking forward to re-listening to this and then also to our next call maybe in a couple of months. So always very much appreciated for coming on and spending this time on the show. And I guess the audience will like it too. So thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Pascal. Always happy to chat with you.
Yeah, enjoy the rest of your day and talk to you later. Bye.
All right.